This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
The experts at Web.com want to build your business a successful website for free, just like we did for these current Web.com customers.
We've used and looked at other website designers, but there's nobody better than Web.com.
Web.com can build your website in as little as 7 days free. Plus, we'll promote it on all the major search engines like Google, Yahoo, and Bing. If after 30 days you're happy, we'll continue to provide promotion, hosting, support, and maintenance, all for one low monthly fee. If not, cancel and pay nothing.
If you're in business today and you don't have a web presence, you won't be taken seriously.
Call right now and you'll also get a free .com or .net domain name for your new website powered by VeriSign, the world's leading domain name provider.
Call 800-490-1099 or go to web.com/radio. That's 800-490-1099.
No upfront charge for site build, after which ongoing fees apply. Rights to site are relinquished when canceled. Domain included during active service, after which fees apply.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. It's Freestyle Friday, so I'm singing you a song.
We're going to have some fun today. Talk about some serious stuff too, but we're going to have some fun.
Going to have some fun, show you how it's done, TGIF.
Any of you remember that? I used to watch TGIF all the time on Fridays. I used to watch, there was a show called Dinosaurs, I think, with like weird little puppet dinosaurs. His little dinosaur baby. Many of you are like, what is Buck talking about? Also a show called Family Matters, where the cop from Die Hard is like a cop in, he's not a cop in real life in either way, but he's a cop who has like a whole family. It's the same guy who plays a police officer who, spoiler alert, at the end of Die Hard, shoots the blonde-haired Russian ballet dancer who was cast as one of the bad guys in that. True story. And I know a bit about Die Hard. I know some things about some Die Hard. But yeah, Carl. I think he's actually Carl in both, too. I think, Ty, you can help me check on this. I think Carl from Die Hard is also, I think he's also called Carl in Family Matters, where he's like a cop, you know, living in like the suburbs or whatever of Chicago. And it's, you know, what's Urkel? Those of you who know Urkel. That's TG. Oh, obviously Full House, which I loved that show. Apparently they made a new one called Fuller House, which is terrible. But and I'm sure it was terrible. Oh, he's Al. Okay, I thought it was Carl in both. So he's Carl in Family Matters. He's Al in Die Hard. Thank you, sir. But anyway, I really like that show. I think some of my most fun nights ever were like before I cared enough about ladies to actually go out and chase them. So I'm like maybe, you know, 12, 13. I think girls still had cooties then. I forget when all of a sudden girls started to be interesting. I think it was like 7th or 8th grade. So maybe like 5th, 6th grade, I'd stay home and play Civilization, Sid Meier's Civilization, and my parents would let me order in from one of the many New York City takeout places that delivers. And I would just sit there and like eat General So chicken and play Civilization with TGIF in the background. So the greatest nights I ever had, I think. Just like pure serenity and bliss and not a care in the world. And then I got older and, you know, had responsibilities and, you know, I don't know, popped up in a couple of war zones, decided to work in media afterwards. Things have changed. All right, let's talk about latest in the news. Unless you want to talk more about Civilization and how those Aztecs would always get uppity with their nuclear weapons. There's not much at this point that I can get outragey about when it comes to the Clinton investigation. There's not a lot that I can sit here and pound the table on because I knew all of this was coming. I think I told you all along, and I'm not pretending that I'm the only one, but there was a 99.9% chance that nothing would come of the Hillary investigation, irrespective of what they found in the investigation. So I already knew that baked into all of this. That we had to prepare ourselves for the fact that there was no chance that there was going to be any. Remember, there could have been criminal sanctions that were much lesser. They could have decided to let her plead a sort of a, you know, mishandling classified at a misdemeanor level. you know, suspension of clearance, but she'd get it back if she won the presidency because you can't take the clearance away from the president. There were any number of things that could have happened. I know people say, you know, lock her up and throw her in prison. That was definitely never going to happen. But there could have at least been some official reprimand on her record. And, you know, I would point out to you, you look at somebody like Scooter Libby, who was caught up in the machinery of a completely preposterous leak investigation where they knew that the leak was accidental, which happens because people walk around and they say things that they're not supposed to say about themselves. You know, people find out and they know, and then people don't know what they know. And then all of a sudden it gets around. And then when they realize that, you know, there's a problem, they can say, oh, well, I don't know. And, you know, we need to have an investigation here. And with the Scooter Libby situation, they pressed charges against him because they said that he lied about a conversation that he had with a journalist. They pressed federal felony charges against him for that. They didn't have any proof. They just figured that his statements in the hours and hours and hours. And this is important context for what I'm going to tell you about the Clinton investigation. They had this guy sit for hours and hours of interrogation with the FBI. And then they feel like they found an inconsistency about an old phone call he had had. This is how it usually is for other citizens. I said I wasn't going to get outragey, and I lied, I guess. I didn't lie, but I misspoke because I am actually getting angry as I talk to you about this. The more I talk to you about it, the angrier I'm going to get. I don't know Scooter Libby. I hold no, you know, personal or professional affection for him. I'd never even heard of him until this whole thing happened. Lewis Libby. We should really call him Lewis Libby. Scooter's his nickname. What's up, Scooter? So Lewis Libby was a senior member of Cheney's staff. This whole thing was an attempt to lock up Cheney, by the way. So people who say, oh, it's terrible that they say lock up Hillary. They actively tried to lock up Cheney. And Bush was a coward on this issue. A capital C coward. And I know people who are very close to all this. I know people who were around during the conversations between some of these senior most figures in the Oval Office. And Bush was so beaten down by the Iraq War and all the press coverage and everything that was going on that he decided that all of a sudden that it wasn't about politics. He wasn't going to get in the way when the whole thing was about politics. And he was the only person who could have stopped it. But you see, that's how Republicans can get guilted into doing the wrong thing because they're trying to do the right thing. Democrats like the Clintons have no shame, so you can't guilt them into anything. They just know it's about power. So Libby, and I was actually in the intel community after that whole thing happened and had to explain to several of my colleagues that Libby wasn't being charged for leaking anything. He didn't leak anything. That was never the charge. The charge was lying to an FBI investigator over the course of hours and hours of interrogation. Kind of, you know, I mean, he's lying about a non-crime is what they're saying. And by the way, it was a he said, she said thing. It was him and Tim Russert, you know, well, I thought he said this. He thought I said that. And then apparently later said, no, he said this and I said that. I mean, you can get up to 5 years in federal prison for that, by the way. I mean, they were going to give him, I think, two. That's a long time to serve in federal prison. By the way, lost his law license, lost his life savings, ruined this guy's life. Oh, Valerie Plame. Oh, yeah, it was so terrible for her. She's doing Vanity Fair covers. She got a $1 million book deal. It was all a scam. All a scam. The left loved it. It was a way. Oh, and Joe Wilson, by the way, super connected to the Clintons, in case you did not know. Super connected to the Clintons. It was a political hit. The whole thing wasn't about justice. And people still don't know the truth. I'm amazed. I had people in talking to me. Oh, well, Scooter Libby. I mean, you can't, you know, he leaked the name. He didn't leak the name. And the prosecutors knew before they even talked to him that he didn't leak the name. He was told the name by other people. He was probably told the name by Tim Russert. He didn't leak anything. And yet, they found something. They needed to get somebody. And Fitzgerald, good little Democrat, wanted to get very high paying job for a big law firm somewhere else, knew that the Clintons take care of their own, knew the politics of the situation. He had to offer up somebody. So they did whatever they could. They looked, they searched high and low for somebody to crucify over this one. Someone on Cheney's staff. They couldn't get Cheney. They tried. Cheney's a crafty fellow. And he didn't do anything wrong, by the way. I mean, you know, it's astonishing to me that to this day, it's still people still don't know the truth. They've never looked up what really happened there. Because if they did, they'd see how the Democrats play the game. Use the law as a weapon, distort justice, ruin lives, political payback, send a message. That's how they do it. That's how Joe Wilson and his wife and people very connected to the Clintons, that's how they play the game. And the media goes all along and they make this ridiculous movie. Like, nah, with like Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. Oh, my God. I mean, I can tell you stories. I had a girl. I'll tell you this now. I had a girlfriend that used to babysit for that family. I can tell you the things that she used to tell me. Oh, it's such a, you know, anybody walks around, I work for the government. What do you do? Oh, I can't say. Ridiculous. Ridiculous. That's what happened there. And yet people still think, oh, Libby, he was a traitor. He didn't do anything. He didn't do anything. Now, why am I so worked up about this? Well, I'm worked up about it because to this day, people don't know the truth. To this day, Andy McCarthy and I, who have talked about this issue, you know, offline at length, I have tremendous personal and professional respect for Andy. And, you know, he doesn't disagree with me on the fact. It's just, you know, he thinks Fitzgerald's a good guy. And I'm like, I think Fitzgerald is. I think Andy's just loyal to somebody that he knows and is a friend. And I can respect that. Look, I've told you about my connection to the Trumps, not because I'm trying to, and not because they're particularly strong. I mean, the Trumps now, if Donald saw me now, I'd be like, who's that? Who's that? You know, who's that clown? He'd have no idea. Ivanka would know. And she'd probably be friendly if there was nobody looking. But if there are people looking, she'd be like, who is that employee of Glenn Beck's? I've never seen him in my life. Be like, really? I'm pretty sure we went to prom together. Anyway, side note. So where were we? Oh, yeah, the Trumps. But I tell you about that because it's harder for me to criticize people that I know. And I respect that with Andy, too, and everything else. So that's, I've told you the background of the Scooter Libby thing, because now we get to talk about how the Clinton, a much more serious and continuous breach, is handled by the Justice Department under the Obama administration and by the FBI and the head of the FBI with the Clintons. Comes out today that Cheryl Mills, who was really Hillary's chief of staff and top political fixer, you know, I mean, just sort of very her. If Huma was her right hand, Cheryl Mills is her left hand. I mean, those are her two sort of top lieutenants. Cheryl Mills was given full immunity by the FBI in the email investigation. In fact, it was contingent on getting any access to her personal laptop or any of her information was contingent on a full immunity deal. So now, when you look at the investigation, when you try to get a sense of what happened here, you see that everybody around Hillary who would have known what was going on or would have been involved at a high enough level to be held responsible for using this personal server to destroy documents under subpoena, to send documents that are classified and keep them housed on unsecure servers, to use different devices on foreign soil that, I mean, you know, everybody who knows anything thinks that if you're using this stuff on foreign soil, there are intelligence agencies that can get access to it and probably almost certainly did. We just can't prove it because we don't have access to the foreign intel databases. All the criminality that could have been involved in this, all the people who could have gotten jammed up in the machinery of the investigation, which would have been very bad for Clinton as well as that person, obviously, they're given immunity, full immunity. Doesn't matter what they found. So if they had Cheryl Mills's laptop and on that laptop there were emails saying, oh, you know, there's, you know, here are the nuclear codes. What? It doesn't matter what it is. And you think of whatever the wildest stuff that you could possibly have in the classified national security realm on her laptop that she's sending around. The FBI doesn't know what they're going to find on there. Full immunity. Full immunity deal. No charges brought. Pagliano, the guy who set up the server and was sort of head of Clinton's IT, full immunity. A number of others get full immunity. And I just want to know, at what point does the FBI just sort of stand up and say, you know what, guys? Yeah, that's right. There are different laws for different sets of people. The Clintons are too powerful. She's going to be our boss. I'm sorry, but we just bent the knee on this one. We wimped out. We've got mortgages to pay. We're just civil servants. By the way, remember how people used to talk about there are going to be resignations? And I laughed. Of course, there aren't going to be resignations. What there are going to be are retributive prosecutions in retribution against anybody who was a little too loud with this issue, a little too difficult. They'll find a way to get even with some of the biggest critics here, because this has been a problem for Hillary. She didn't expect it to be the case. House Oversight Committee Chairman Chaffetz, who's been looking into this, said that federal investigators, this is from the New York Post, were given access to Mills' computer, but only on the condition the FBI's findings could not be used against her. He says, no wonder they couldn't prosecute a case. They were handing out immunity deals like candy. John Bentel, director of State Department's Office of Information Resource Management, he got full immunity. Clinton aide Heather Samuelson, she got full immunity. Brian Pagliano, he got full immunity. And they were never going to bring charges against Hillary. But they had to go through the steps of the investigation. But by going through those steps, they might have stumbled upon criminality in some of the secondary targets of the investigation. So in order to prevent the embarrassment and the problem of possibly having to bring, that's right, Scooter Libby-like charges, i.e. process or procedural charges against the people around Hillary Clinton, they made sure they covered all their bases with them so that they wouldn't be in a position where they go, well, Cheryl Mills definitely broke the law. We got to prosecute her. They're all covered. They're all clean, free, good to go. And then at the end, they can look at Hillary and just be like, we decline charges. The fix was in from the beginning. And the fix was so, this is not just we think the referee was paid off before the game. I already told you the referees were paid off before the game. This is, the referee's son plays for one of the teams, and he was wearing the jersey of that team while reffing the game. I mean, this is as blatant as it gets, everyone. This should destroy your faith in the Justice Department, if you have any. It should destroy your faith, quite honestly, in the senior leadership of the FBI in doing what's right and doing justice. And they still have the power and the authority to destroy lives across the country for political purposes. And they will do so, especially under a Clinton administration. One of the main reasons I am never Hillary. These people don't play fair. They don't play right. They are a disgrace, and they will destroy those who stand in their way. I remember what it was like for people who opposed them in the 90s, even though I was just a youngin'. I remember. All right. Sponsor this half hour, silencershop.com. Look, silencershop.com has the best and widest selection. They have the most knowledgeable staff. They're friendly. They'll help you get through the process. Customers can trust that Silencer Shop is going to make sure your applications get through the process quickly. They submit more forms than anybody else in this business by a huge margin. And when you purchase a silencer from silencershop.com, you simply pick it up at a local dealer with no transfer fees and no shipping. A silencer is awesome. It makes a shooting experience more fun. You're going to enjoy yourself more out on the range, out while you're hunting. It can also help a bit with your accuracy, reduces recoil, and yes, it looks cool. So check out silencershop.com for all the latest. They'll explain it all to you there. You can pick out what you want, and they'll help you get through, and you will get yourself a silencer. Silencershop.com. Again, silencershop.com. Help make the world a quieter place. We will be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Hey team, it's Buck. Have you tried a Casper mattress yet? They are incredible. They're obsessively engineered, and they come at a shockingly fair price for a mattress that brings together technology and comfort to also be a great value is just too much for any of you to pass up. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and the perfect bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. It is an award-winning mattress that absolutely will not disappoint. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. And for listeners of this show, you can get a special $50 toward any mattress by going to casper.com/buck. Casper.com/buck and using buck as the code. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
What faith can any of us have that the Clintons won't use the Justice Department to go after their critics and enemies with I mean, just with a completely free hand under a Hillary administration. They've already shown us, before she's even president, that they act like she's the commander in chief and they have to protect her. I mean, this is Praetorianism, right? This is, for those of you who don't know, the Praetorian Guard was the personal bodyguard of the, well, the Emperor of Rome, of the Caesars. And Praetor is a rank in the Roman military. But Praetorian Guard is, if you've ever seen the movie Gladiator, then you've seen the Praetorian Guard. They're sort of the ones that do the bidding of the Emperor, and they don't come off very well on that. And in later emperorships or whatever, they actually become too powerful. And anyway, I'm getting kind of on a tangent there. Point being, Praetorianism is when there are people who are just, all they want to do is protect the regime. And that's what I'm seeing here with the FBI. They realize who the boss is going to be. And, you know, Praetorianism is when sort of security forces, and sometimes including the military, are used for their primary goal is to protect the regime in power, not to protect the constitutional order, not to protect the laws of the country, not to swear to uphold and defend the Constitution. So a Praetorianistic America would be one in which the FBI and the Department of Justice swear to uphold and protect the Clinton dynasty. And that's where we are. We are at a place where the Department of Justice is a Praetorian Guard for Hillary Clinton, and that's deeply depressing. It's also kind of terrifying. This is why I want Hillary to lose. Yeah, I know, Trump, it could get wild, it could be bad, but Hillary has to lose, everybody. More coming.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton,
the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, the phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. It's Friday. Would love to take some calls. Like to have a little chat. Hey, let's have a little chat, everybody. Let's have a talk. Yeah. What do you want to discuss? What do you think about all this Hillary investigative stuff? It just particularly annoys me. Everybody I know who used to live under the tyranny of the federal government's classification rules and, you know, it's just the fact that there are the different sets of rules in some ways is what annoys me the most, because it'd be one thing if they're like, you know what, some of these rules are too crazy. We need to relax on this stuff a little bit. There needs to be sort of a higher standard of intent. And I'd be like, all right, well, at least it's the same rules for everybody. You know, people talk about declassifying more or sort of raising the standard for violation of some of these rules and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, actually, I'm in favor of some of that. I really am. But I'm in favor of it for everybody. I'm not in favor of it for people that have amassed a vast fortune for themselves by selling political influence and selling their office and destroying the trust. Or I would hope that trust in them has been destroyed in a sense, but a lot of people don't realize that trust put in them by the American people, as is the case with the Clintons. I just can't, just not okay with them. I mean, I got to say, you know, Obama, for all of his faults, ethically, ideologically, Obama is, I'm as opposed to Obama ideologically as I am to the Clintons, perhaps even more so in some ways. I think Obama's a little left of Hillary on some things. I think that's fair to say. Although on different issues of statism, Hillary might even be I don't know. It's sort of tough. You'd really have to line them up. That'd be kind of an interesting exercise. Where is Obama to the left of Hillary, and where is Hillary to the left of Obama? But on ethical issues, look, Obama knows that he's already worth like 15 or 20 million bucks. They're going to pay him $10 million for his memoirs. He's going to be making $300,000 a speech for the next, you know, 10 years. And he'll be on the boards of huge companies that just will pay him to put his name on their board. I mean, the guy's going to be worth, Obama's going to be worth $50 to $100 million very soon without breaking a sweat. But that's okay for him. You know, he's, let's say $50 million. He's going to be happy to be worth $50 million and, never have to sort of like have a hard day's work from here on out for the rest of his life. I think he's going to be okay with that. With the Clintons, it had to be, let's raise $2 billion and let's enrich all of our friends and let's be worth $150 million and let's do it by completely conflating charity, government work, private sector, enrichment. I mean, just all of the... Ugh, it's so gross. They're so unacceptable in every way. And that's one of the reasons why I know all the problems with Trump. And look, there's stuff about Trump that bothers me. I mean, we certainly don't share taste. His taste runs towards the garish, the meretricious. Just bust out some SAT words because it's Friday. Why not? But he's not Hillary. At least he's doing it in the private sector. At least he wasn't selling government office. I'll say that. Yeah. Was he probably ripping people off? Was he shady sometimes in his business dealings? Yeah, of course. I'm sure he was. Was Trump University, was it good? Was it bad? I don't know. It sounds kind of dumb to me. But honestly, a lot of universities are a waste. If we were letting them go down that path, a lot of these for-profit universities. Oh, by the way, what was the for-profit that Clinton was on the board of? I can't remember the name of it right now. But he was paid $14 million to be the honorary chancellor of a university that has been accused of all kinds of shadiness and ripping people off. And it's a global university. Hold on, I'll look up the name of this. Clinton Chancellor. I know we're on air, but I don't want to. What was the name of this place? It was called, here it comes, Laureate Education Incorporated. And there's all kinds of connections between Clinton and the Laureate people, and it's so gross. Yeah, $16.46 billion over 5 years while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So this is an international for-profit university that's paying the Secretary of State's husband $16 million to just use his name. That seems like a good gig. Would you take that gig? I'd take that gig. They get to put your name. Yeah, Ty says he'd be down for that. $16 million to call you the honorary chancellor? Nobody thinks the honorary chancellor does anything. We all know that, right? So that's kind of a joke. But it's the more you get into this stuff. And I just wonder, too. Oh, by the way, yeah, the Clinton State Department was pumping millions of dollars into a nonprofit, which was run by Laureate's founder and chairman, Douglas Becker. And State Department funding skyrocketed, according to Breitbart here, and according to Bloomberg. Here we go. A Bloomberg examination of IYF, International Youth Foundation's public filings, show that in 2009, the year before Bill Clinton joined Laureate, the nonprofit received 11 grants worth $9 million from the State Department or the affiliated USAID. In 2010, the group received 14 grants worth $15.1 million. In 2011, 13 grants worth $14.6 million. The following year, those numbers jumped. IYF received 21 grants worth $25 million, including a direct grant through the State Department. So Hillary, just to bring this all together, is the head of the State Department. The State Department, all of a sudden, while she's Secretary of State, is giving tens of millions of dollars in grant money to an affiliated foundation of an international for-profit university that has Bill Clinton as its chancellor and is paying him $16 million for the pleasure of using his name. But that's not corruption. That's just coincidence, right? It's just lucky. I mean, my name is worth like at least 16, maybe even more. I mean, they got a bargain, really. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's, you know, 16 million, maybe he's worth 60. I mean, people just, they hear Bill Clinton, they think I'm a genius. They want to be a genius, too. It's great. What's up, ladies? Haven't talked to you in a while. It's Friday. You want to go out tonight? It's just appalling, especially the stuff about Bill Clinton and the ladies, but it's appalling. And I don't mean to sound like the old sort of school dean here who's just like, this is wrong, but that's kind of how I feel about the whole thing. And to my friends who are Democrats, I kind of want to look at them, and I get it, right? I mean, it's really, they just figure Hillary represents the issues, you know, you go down the checklist and she'll give them what they want and they don't really care about all the rest of it. I just worry what happens to the country. I mean, I have so little faith in the justice system or the FBI at this point. to operate fairly whenever politics are involved. And so much is politicized right now. It's very hard. Yeah, sure. I mean, do I think the FBI will still get, you know, child molesters and drug dealers and, you know, murderers? And they, yeah, I think they're still going after the right people on that. But the moment that an issue becomes politicized, there's any political lens to it whatsoever, the government apparatus itself, the bureaucracy has been corrupted and has been really co-opted, actually. That's part of the corruption. It's really a wing of the Democratic Party at this point. That's where it is. And Democrats just play the game differently. They play to win, and we have people dancing around talking about who supports the Constitution the most and who knows the most about the Founding Fathers. I mean, not that those aren't important things, but, you know, while we're having a who can recite the amendments in order competition among conservatives and getting angry at people who want to win and aren't really that focused on that issue, the Democrats are just like, okay, how do we become powerful and destroy our enemies? That's their approach. Very straightforward. 888-900-3393. Love to see some calls. It's been a while since we've chatted. It's been at least 24 hours. We'll be back after this break.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network.
They really don't make this easy sometimes. I'm just seeing here on Twitter that Eric Trump, whom I knew when he was a pudgy little kid and had an accidental mullet, true story, he, now I think he's like 6'4", and, you know, is going to inherit a whole lot of money. He went on TV and said his father's the epitome of the American dream. He started with just about nothing. This is what I don't. Yeah, Ty's laughing. I'm laughing. I mean, I'm laughing and crying at the same time. This is why I'll have to, if I go on CNN, they'll say, why does Trump say these things? And I go, I don't know. He inherited a huge real estate portfolio. And now we're being told that also he got a $10 million loan from his dad, you know, to get things started as well. It's, you know, $10 million in the 70s was even more money than it is now. Thank you, Ty. Ty's right on the ball here. He said $43 million if you adjust for inflation. That's starting on third base and then getting walked home after lots of bad pitches. I mean, that's not difficult. I'm sorry. And I don't know why they lie about things like this. I just look, you've got two people running for the presidency who are both liars. I think one of them is a liar as like a, it's sort of out of a habit of salesmanship and showmanship and sort of, you know, well, it's a little slimy. I'm not going to pretend it's not. That's on the Trump side. But the other one's a liar about like, hey, did I sell nuclear secrets to the Chinese? No, of course not. So I just feel like it's more serious. And it's more serious when you're lying in a position of public trust. Or at least it's more serious to me than when you're in your sort of business dealings that, you know, buyer beware. Look, there's also fraud. I mean, there are criminal lies that can be told over the course of investigations and such, too. But anyway, I don't know why they do this. I don't know why he clings to I was opposed to the Iraq war thing as a huge talking point. Although the media really fights back on that because they fight back on that one because it's what he points to as Hillary's sort of flip-flopping, hypocritical nature and her poor judgment and, you know, a number of things like that. So they have to sort of fight him on that one, and that's why they get so into, ooh, that's such a bad lie. That's such a big deal. It's not such a bad lie. I think it's one of those issues where there's some gray. There is some gray to it, but not a ton. Anyway, Trump started with a lot of money. He's not really a self-made guy. I mean, he did build the brand into something much bigger. I think you give him credit for that, but I don't know. How would I do if I inherited $100 million? I'd like to think I'd still be here talking to all of you on radio, but I probably would have done some pretty cool things with that money. having a lot of money, those many of you already know, once your expenses are covered, then you can make decisions that you can't otherwise make. A vast majority of us are just trying to keep enough money in the bank or maybe under the mattress to pay our bills. And that's the focus all the time. You maybe want to start that business. You want to run with that idea, but you never have the opportunity to do so. This is the reality of the American dream. And yeah, you can mortgage your house and you can sort of throw it all. You can go all in on something. But if you have a family, if you have kids and it doesn't work out, now you're in a really tough spot. You know, if you're a single person, I've kind of decided to go all in on this media thing. There were much safer and probably wiser career paths for me to try. I left what was really the most secure form of employment on the planet, being a federal government employee, for the among the least secure and most stressful, which is trying to make a living in media. And you know, to this day, just focused on trying to pay the bills. Not like Bill Clinton trying to pay the bills. I love when he says that. You know, they're already worth over $100 million. I mean, he could sit on municipal bonds making $5 million a year tax-free of just income off of the $100 million, never mind the properties and other things that they own. But he acts like, you know, it's really – and they have the Clinton Foundation picking up their travel everywhere and everything else. But this is – I think, Marco, I would tell you this, and I know no one can prove me wrong because it's just a supposition or it's just my sort of wild guess. I think Marco Rubio would be up 10 points on Hillary right now. I think Ted Cruz would be up a solid 4, 5, 6 points on Hillary right now. I think Jeb Bush would probably be up, you know, a point or two on Hillary right now. I think Kasich might even be tied with Hillary right now. I mean, you know. There are a lot of options here. And people would tell me, well, Buck, Trump's ahead in some polls. But I don't know. Most of the polls that I've seen still give Hillary a slight edge. But I think that, wow. If we could have only, I was going to say, if we could turn back time. And then I started to have a Cher moment. Isn't that the video where she's like on a battleship and wearing just like tights and things like that, right? I used to watch too much MTV. Yeah, Cher. Interesting. So if we had known that the Clinton brand would be where it is now when we were in the primary, I don't know. I mean, obviously the Trump people would have voted for him anyway, but you've got to look at this whole thing and say, what a missed opportunity. She is so vulnerable in all this stuff. And the problem is that the media can still say, well, Trump lies too. They even say Trump lies more, which he may beat her in frequency, but he does not beat her in severity. In my opinion, doesn't even come close. None of Trump's lies, as far as I know, are about criminal matters or are about him being a criminal. So start there. But the media will say, oh, no, he lies so much more. I think it was Ben Shapiro I saw in an interview recently where he pointed out, and this is something that I've thought because I've been on the screen when they do this. Only with Trump will they run a Chyron on CNN, on MSNBC. Chyron is a sort of little banner at the bottom of the screen. Well, they run one that says Trump says this and then in parentheses, but he lied. They never do that with Hillary. And I've even had people challenge me on how many classified emails Hillary actually had that were classified at the time on air. And I was right. And the show knew I was right. And the producers knew I was right. And we agreed in the break and they all knew. Do you think they corrected it when we came back on air? I'll give you one guess.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, welcome to hour two in the Freedom Hut. Joined by our friend Guy Benson. He is the politics editor at townhall.com, also a Fox News contributor and author of End of Discussion. Guy, great to have you as always.
Hey, Buck, happy Friday.
Happy Friday, my friend. So we got big debate coming up on Monday. I'm seeing a couple of polls here saying Clinton is up by about 6, right? There's this McClatchy-Maris poll out today, also earlier in the week,
Wall Street Journal poll, I think, says that roughly 6 points, Clinton has a lead. What do you think going into all this stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, and then there's also the Associated Press poll that also put it around 6 points. So, meanwhile, there are some other polls that show a closer race. I think that the first debate is really important. All three debates, of course, are always important, but there's a lot of people who are estimating that Monday night's clash is going to draw a record audience. The moderate record, by the way, was Romney and Obama in that first debate in 2012, which was probably the highlight of Romney's campaign, where he just crushed Obama and really made it a race again because he had been slipping and Romney's decisive victory really helped him. That was about 68 million people who tuned in for that one. I've seen people expecting up to maybe 100 million people to watch this. And people like you and me find it hard to believe, but it is true that of those, let's say 100 million, millions of them are really tuning into the race for the first time. They know who Hillary is. They know who Trump is overall, but they haven't really thought about the election that carefully. They haven't seen them necessarily ever head-to-head. So there's a curiosity factor. And I think what Hillary needs to do, her expectations are just naturally going to be significantly higher because she's run a campaign saying, I'm the most qualified person to ever run for this office ever, and my opponent is a lunatic and a madman and a monster who knows nothing. So she has helped set these expectations both for himself, for herself and for him. So she needs to, she doesn't need the RNC put out a memo saying she needs to be nearly flawless to win. I don't know about that, but she needs a decisive victory, or else it will look like an underperformance on her part. Whereas Donald Trump, I do believe he is losing this race right now. He is in a much better position than he was 5-6 weeks ago. There's no question about it. He has the opportunity to win this race, but two of the things that are holding him back in virtually every single poll that we've seen, including the new ones that you referenced, Buck, large majorities, like super majorities of voters, believe that he is not qualified to be president and doesn't have the temperament to be president. He has a chance to take on those vulnerabilities head on by coming across as relatively prepared, rational, and plausible. He's not going to get a majority of people to flip their mind all of a sudden and say, oh my gosh, he's super qualified and his temperament's amazing. He just has to shift that number and move the needle enough, because despite his deep, deep problems on those candidate characteristics questions, he's still, on average, only about 2 or 3 points down nationally to Hillary Clinton.
What do you think he needs to do in order to close the gap? I mean, if I could, I know this is going to be kind of a funny image for you perhaps, Guy, but if I made you Trump's debate coach, you know, he sat down with him, what does a strong Trump performance, what would it involve and how would it have to come across?
Well, I think they would use the same blueprint that they used for that Mexico trip, where everyone's like, oh, here we go. Trump's going to Mexico. Get out the popcorn. And then he was very subdued, deferential, respectful. He stuck to the script and exceeded very low expectations. And so if I were advising Trump, I don't know if he has it in him to bone up on policy. I don't think he cares about policy. I don't think that that's really who he is or what he's about. So to me, that's a fruitless endeavor. I do worry that for 90 minutes one-on-one, there's nowhere for him to hide, right? On that stage, it's going to be half the time him talking. And if he's clearly off topic or non-responsive in a way where it looks like he's, again, the kid who hasn't done the reading and he gets called on by the teacher, that's not a good look. But overall, number one, don't take the bait from Hillary. She is going to try to bait him into some sort of an outburst that will underscore what people already think, which is that he has this terrible temperament and he really shouldn't be the most powerful person in the world because of it. If he can keep his cool, he doesn't have to take insults lying down, but if he can, remain, calm and use a steady voice, I think that would go a long way. Well, like, it's visual clues. How do people feel watching him? Do they feel like he is plausibly someone who could be president? Or is he sort of this agitated-looking loose cannon, if he can go more with the former as opposed to the latter, I think that would go a long way in just sort of the vibe that people get off of him, which is voters are very intuitive. You know, voters are not, for the most part, really all that interested in every single policy specific. I think she'll run circles around him on policy specifics. That's expected. They want to figure out, looking at Donald Trump, is this guy someone who actually could be the president? Do I go with, I kind of want to vote against Hillary. I don't really like this woman, but gosh, he doesn't strike me as someone who is remotely presidential. If he can start to allay some of those doubts for a significant number of undecided or persuadable voters, that's where he has the opportunity to really gain on her.
And on the Hillary side of things, I mean, I assume that she's going to try to just burnish her credentials as much as she can. She's going to be essentially waving her resume around on stage, which perhaps will be useful in encouraging that perception that Trump is by no means ready for this office, and she's, you know, ready for Hillary, and everyone's ready for Hillary, and it's going to be just great. But I have to say, I think that there's the possibility that she gets a little bit jammed up on the honesty issue, because that's one place where it seems like, first of all, that she has no good responses. And also, Trump has gone after her on that in a way that I think is more effective, or gone after sort of the, you know, with crooked Hillary and that sort of thing in a way that might be more effective than some of the other Republicans would have. So I think there's a chance for him to score some big points. But as you say, it depends on what his demeanor is. And 90 minutes is a long time. I don't know how many times you can get away with saying, I'm going to make America great again and we're going to do good deals.
Right. And so I think that that's true. And there was a really good insight from one of my colleagues who writes at hotair.com, Ala Pandit. He noticed from a recent speech from Donald Trump this week, one of the lines that he really emphasized in his speech was, if you vote for Hillary Clinton, nothing is going to change. Nothing. And I think that is such an important argument for Trump to get back to over and over again, where she can come out and say, look at all of my impressive resume points. I was Secretary of State. I was a senator. I was First Lady. I have deep knowledge. And he can say, and how's that working out? 70% of the country says we're on the wrong track. Your top supporters can't even name a major accomplishment to help the American people from your 30 years in Washington, D.C., enriching yourself in this, you know, cronyist cesspool. So there's a way to really come after her and tap into the fact that for years now, by a large margin, the American people believe that this country is headed in the wrong direction. And the idea that Hillary Clinton, personally, I don't believe that Donald Trump has the solutions or the wherewithal to fix things. He says that he does, and he asserts it, and that's fine. And his supporters believe it's fine. But I think it is inarguable that if you are sitting here looking at the direction of the country and you're part of the 60 to 70% of Americans who believe we're on the wrong track, the notion that electing Hillary Clinton as president is going to be, you know, some sort of change-inducing moment where she's going to be an agent for positive change, I just think that that is a really tough sell, because she's just a careerist who's out for herself, who's made a lot of money in this whole process, and is basically saying, I'm just going to continue this status quo, the Obama-Clinton status quo that people aren't particularly thrilled with, just for some more years. And I just think that that is a very weak argument to make for yourself, especially when you're as unlikable and distrusted as she is.
Do you think it's fair to say there's been a Trump campaign pivot, that things have sort of shaped up a bit, and it's more serious than it was in the past?
Yes. I mean, I think that my theory, and there's been some reporting on this, my theory is that Kellyanne Conway came in as his new campaign manager, and that was when the shift happened. He was down by 10 points in the national polling after those conventions, and he was in trouble. He was in serious trouble. And so he brought on Kellyanne Conway. Hillary Clinton started to have a really bad stretch of headlines, which, you know, redounded to his benefit as well. But he did clean up his act. And I think Kellyanne Conway said, look, I'm a professional pollster. I've been doing this for my entire career. You are losing. We have to control our message better. Ivanka has been an advocate for that approach as well. Apparently, she and Kellyanne have become allies and friends in this whole campaign. And so Trump was, for example, no longer constantly obsessing and engaging in stupid, counterproductive feuds. He backed away from the cons thing. He has not been race baiting any judges recently. So he just, again, the low expectations thing, he cleaned up his act a little bit, which was enough, coupled with Hillary's bad stretch, to close the gap again to a margin of error race. I think she is still the front runner, but there is an opening for him, and Monday night is really important for him to take advantage.
How is it looking right now on the Senate side of things? You've been taking a look. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's actually, I think coming into this cycle, everyone agreed this is going to be a tough row to hoe for the Republicans to maintain their majority, just because we're now 6 years after the 2010 Republican landslide year. They've got a lot more seats to defend in battleground states. The Democrats need to gain on net 4 or 5 seats, depending on who wins the presidency, and they have a lot of ways to get there. They still absolutely could. This is a toss-up, in my view. But the Republicans have made a lot of gains where their incumbents are outpolling and outperforming Trump in their states. Ohio, as opposed to being a big pickup opportunity for the Democrats, looks gone for them. Rod Portman's up double digits. Marco Rubio looking pretty good in terms of his standing down in Florida. Certain places like Missouri, Arizona, North Carolina, Democrats thought they had chances there. Those don't seem to be panning out right now. Kelly Ayotte has jumped back into the lead in New Hampshire. That's a good sign for her. Pat Toomey neck and neck in Pennsylvania. And then out in Nevada, it's the one seat that the Democrats, I think, are worried about losing. It's Harry Reid's seat. He's blessedly retiring. The Republican in that race, Joe Heck, very impressive guy, he has led in every public poll head-to-head with the Democrats. So there are now a number of different ways that I can envision the Republicans holding that Senate majority, regardless of who wins the presidential race.
All right. So all of our hopes do not rest on the Trump campaign. At least all Republican hopes, I should say, do not rest on the Trump campaign. Guy, what's your latest up on Town Hall?
So I wrote about the strategy memo from the Republicans trying to play up expectations for Hillary Clinton ahead of the debate. And basically, I don't think anyone needs to pre-spin this debate, is my bottom line. The American people have very set views of what they expect Hillary Clinton to be able to do and what they think Donald Trump might do. Those are the expectations from which both campaigns will operate. And then it'll be a massive battle for the narrative after the debate, depending on what happens. I am really excited, actually, for Monday night. It is going to be a fascinating display of politics.
It is indeed. I'm excited, too. We can nerd out on Twitter, Guy. It's going to be fun. There'll be lots of running commentary, I'm sure, on the debates. Guy Benson is the politics editor at townhall.com. You should check out Town Hall. Also, author of End of Discussion, and you'll see him on Fox News, where he is a contributor. Guy, great to have you, buddy. Thanks for making time on a Friday.
No problem. Thanks, Buck.
All right, team, we've got more. We'll be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Kevin in New Jersey, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Welcome.
Hey, Buck.
What's up?
So I wanted to ask you, because I know a lot of people are constantly saying, hey, how can anybody support Hillary with this email scandal and her terrible foreign policy track record, and really for the Democrats, their foreign policy track record. And one thing I wanted to submit to you is, I think for a lot of people, and this is not my viewpoint, but just the viewpoint of many liberals that I've talked to, it really doesn't matter, which is maybe surprising to a lot of people, but let me explain. As far as the emails go, although the cover-up has been horrendous and very obvious, I think a lot of people are actually just viewing it based on what's been released by the FBI and by the government is essentially just gossip. So essentially what a lot of people have in their
Hold on a second, Kevin. What's gossip exactly?
So what's been released so far, because most of it has been classified and not released, has been just a lot of back and forth about he said, she said, or things like...
Oh, so you're saying we because it's redacted, we can't actually see the classified that was shared?
Exactly. And so okay. What is released are things like from the DNC hack, where we get a lot of, Colin Powell said this about Hillary, or the DNC said this about Mexicans, but it's not anything that most Americans who don't pay a lot of attention to politics or really honestly even the news can get a grasp on, other than to say, wow, this is very interesting. It's like the political version of Entertainment Tonight. And as far as foreign policy goes, I think a lot of people, including myself, often wonder, how can the American people ever vote for a Democrat, knowing their track record on foreign policy? And I took a step back and I sort of thought about it, and I realized that in today's world, I think a lot of Americans are really shielded from having to worry about foreign policy, and that a lot of Americans really don't know anything about foreign policy. And what I mean by that is that, for example, when you talk about the Iran deal that Obama made, in those instances, a lot of the impact has been removed from the deal by people who argue and have successfully argued, and it's probably true, that Iran's going to get the nukes no matter what.
Right, okay. And
so that's one thing. The second thing is that with all of these things, it's very delayed, so that you have the Iran deal now. If they get nukes 10 years in the future, 5 years in the future, most people won't even be paying attention. They'll just react to it at that moment and say, now they have nukes, now we need to deal with it, and not have a concern about how did we get to this place.
All right. Keith, we got to get you a podcast too, my man. You've got a lot to say. Oh, he left? Okay. Bye. I didn't say that. Oh, whatever. I guess he left. Has that become an unofficial like code word? But I'm like, you need a podcast. I'm like, yank him. That's not what I meant. But he had a lot to say there. Look, on the point about the email, that's people tell me some crazy stuff. And I mean people who know about what's in those emails. And we're not allowed to know. We are not allowed to see what the classified is. They've sort of spread this, oh, it's overclassification stuff. But I've heard that there's really, really legitimately sensitive secret stuff in there. Dangerously secret stuff in those emails. I can't prove that because I can't see them. We can't see them. But I've been told that by people who know what the heck they're talking about when it comes to classified and say that they have sources. And, you know, that's what they're telling me. So there's that. And yeah, on foreign policy, I think foreign policy is something that people love to talk about in the media. I don't know how much other than terrorism and now I guess trade deals, the rest of the country pays attention to foreign policy as a function of motivating their vote one way or the other. I'd be kind of curious about that. But I got a lot more to talk about with you, my friends. 888-900-3393. We will be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth.
This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, we're very fortunate to be joined by our friend Sean Davis. He is airdropping in with some truth. He's unleashing it like Rambo with an M60. What's up, my friend?
Not much. I often get compared to Rambo.
You on Twitter, you're like the Rambo of Twitter, annihilating trolls left and right. It's one of my favorite things. I see Sean Davis just eviscerating the nincompoops. Sean is also, by the way, not just the Rambo of freedom and truth, but co-founder of The Federalist. And so you should all check out his fantastic website, thefederalist.com. Him and Ben Domenech are the founders. All right, Sean, we've got like a whole bunch of things I want to get to. Let's start with your piece on The Federalist about how Trevor Noah, who is, I think, TV's most unfunny comedian, especially for sort of the perch that he has been given. And it's funny, even my liberal friends who were angry at me when I said that this show won't last a year before either he gets pulled off the air, everybody realizes that it sucks, because it does. They agree. They agree that he's not funny and it's not a good show. But putting that aside, putting my editorializing aside for a second, you say that he destroys the case for gun control on his own show. Please walk us through it.
Yeah, so as you know, and I think your audience knows, liberals love during the John Stewart era to drop links on Facebook and Twitter about how John Stewart just destroyed the case for something. Well, Trevor Noah destroyed the case for gun control because after the Minnesota stabbing, he decided he was going to mock some of the people responding to it. And one of them was an ice cream shop owner about 100 miles southeast of St. Cloud who put up a sign that said, "Muslims, get out." And Trevor Noah just thought this was, you know, super racist and also really dumb, because according to Trevor Noah, what kind of dumb terrorist is going to go look at a sign and say, "Welp, I'm not allowed here," and then get out? And then Trevor Noah said, you know, how come we've never thought about that as a national defense strategy? We'll just put up no terrorist signs at the airport. And then he and his little audience of clapping seals, clap, 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 thought that was just such a brilliant little bon mot from him. Except, unfortunately for Trevor, he had no clue that he just made an airtight argument against the stupidity of gun-free zones.
Wait, we'll play the Noah audio, and then we'll have Sean keep telling us more about this. But play it. Go.
It's also strange. This man genuinely thought people who go around blowing people up would be stopped by a sign? You realize you're talking to terrorists, not vampires. They don't need to be invited in. Right? Or maybe he's onto something, because if you think about it, we've never tried that. We've never actually tried to repel terrorists with signs. Yeah, maybe that's all the airports need, is a sign that says, "No terrorists," yes? Yeah, and then guys are going to be walking going, "Oh, I was going to blow up the airport, but the rules are rules. They said they can't come in. They said they can't come in.
First of all, I think he used a sort of pseudo-Arab accent there, which is a microaggression. Second of all...
Oh, yes. Come for the idiotic arguments and stay for the casual linguistic slurring of mother.
Right? I mean, you know, can you imagine if a conservative was like, "I'm going to go and kill," you know, they just started pulling out the, like, Crimson Jihad accent all of a sudden? People would freak out, which I just started to do there, of course. But so the gun-free zone, yeah, it seems like a pretty direct parallel. No guns will stop mass shootings, just like no terrorists will stop terrorists. I see the connection here.
Yeah, the whole argument against gun control is that bad people will do bad things using whatever tools they have to do those bad things. If they want to blow you up, they don't care that there's a law against bombs. If they want to stab you, they don't care if there's a law against stabbing. If they want to put a pressure cooker in a garbage can in the middle of Manhattan, they're going to do it even though there's a law against turning pressure cookers into bombs. That's the whole point. That's why gun control doesn't work, because bad people do bad things when they want to do bad things, regardless of laws against those bad things. And what was so amazing about Noah's little rant destroying the "Muslims get out" sign is the total lack of self-awareness. That no one on his staff, none of his writers, nobody in his audience, not even him, had the slightest clue that they had just made a perfect argument against the stupidity of gun-free zones, which, by the way, is where all these mass shootings tend to happen. They don't happen at gun ranges or in gun stores. They happen at gun-free zones.
Yeah, there's been so many of them. I mean, you list some of them in your piece on The Federalist. You go down the list of the most, I mean, not we don't have to look hard for them. The biggest mass shootings that come to mind in the last 5 years, gun-free zones almost 2-1. I mean, they're Aurora, Sandy Hook, Orlando. I mean, you go down the list, San Bernardino, all gun-free zones.
Right, and like I said, I didn't have to look. It's almost become a cliche that as soon as there's a mass shooting, you can pretty much guarantee that it happened in a gun-free zone. And the reason is that these murderous terrorists who don't care about laws know that we actually do. So they know that we're going to be bound by the laws. If we see a sign that says no guns prohibited by law in this area, we're not going to carry guns. But they know that they're not restricted by that. So when they go in there, it's fish in a barrel. They're not going to have to worry about any opposition, about anyone shooting back at them. They're going to have free reign over the place. And it's just amazing to me that the self-styled smart set, the New York elitists, can't see such an obvious argument when they wrote it themselves and put it in front of their own face.
I wanted to ask you about these two big news stories from the week over shootings, one in Tulsa and one in Charlotte. Let's start with the Tulsa one. The police officer involved, or the one who actually shot Terrence Crutcher, has been charged with first-degree manslaughter. I know I'm asking you about this, and not all the facts are out, and this still has to sort of go through the process, and there is, of course, a presumption of innocence here, legally speaking, right? We're media commentators, so we can just kind of give our opinions as long as they're tied to the facts. What do you think about this? I mean, this is this has what implications, and what's your sense of whether is this a political charge? Do you think it's probably warranted based on the facts? Where do you come down?
The one in Oklahoma is really difficult. I think that'll end up being a difficult case. It will come down to whether people believe that police officer had a reasonable suspicion that the man was going to, pull a gun from his waist, pull it out of his pocket. That one's trickier. The Scott one is interesting. So by according to public records and public accounts, Scott, who is the man who was shot by a black cop in Charlotte, North Carolina, was a convicted felon. He served 7 years in prison for aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Now, under current federal gun laws, if you fit that profile, if you are convicted or even indicted of a crime which carries more than a one-year sentence, you are banned from even so much as touching a weapon. You can't touch it, you can't carry it, you can't own it, you can't possess it. And so it raises some questions about, if he had an ankle holster. It certainly appears like he had a gun. If he had been following the gun laws that said people like him, violent felons, who can't have guns, if he had followed that law, would he still be alive today?
Yeah, it seems like that's very possibly the case. I've seen the photo, the sort of still shot, that is purportedly a gun on the ground next to him. Also, you mentioned the one charge where he served 7 years. He has many charges stretching before that. This is a guy who's in trouble with the law a lot.
Right, and there are people who will come and say, well, is it
violent trouble, by the way, just to throw that out there. Violent trouble.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right, yeah, there's one report that he shot at a cop in Texas. So the retort will be, well, in North Carolina, open carry is allowed, and so none of this should happen to him. Well, again, under federal law and state law in North Carolina, you don't have the right to open carry a weapon if you're a convicted felon who served 7 years in prison. That's just a fact. And for all the stuff we hear about common sense federal gun laws, and we need common sense gun restrictions, if he had followed them, there's a good chance that we wouldn't be talking about his death today.
And, I just to go back to the Tulsa shooting for a second, I mean, I agree with your assessment. This is seems like from what we know right now, a much closer call in terms of whether it is sort of a criminally negligent action on the part of the officer, which does happen. And I'm not sure if it was in Oklahoma. It was, where was that? The deputy who was sort of a weekend warrior deputized guy who shot some guy in the head. And it was an accident. I mean, he basically
that was in New York. That was a Kai Gurley was the man who was shot. The officer and someone else were for some reason doing
it was in New York?
In a project building. Yeah, in a dark stairwell.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the guy who was on the ground face down and the deputized,
Oh, yeah, yes, I'm sorry.
Sorry, that's a different case, where the deputized officer who had sort of like given a lot of money to the local police precinct just pulled the trigger and shot the guy who was on the ground. He wasn't trying to execute the guy, but he messed up and he killed somebody and it was involuntary
right.
Manslaughter. This seems like not quite as clear as that. That was pretty clear. But if this guy... unless there was a really credible action that would make her think that she was in reasonable fear for her safety or those around her, if she got overexcited and pulled the trigger, she's going to have to pay the penalty. So that's what we're going to see play out here. What I think is interesting is that, by the way, even if there is, let's say that she's found guilty, theoretically, right? the and it's interesting also, by the way, that the Charlotte case, which is much less close, at least to me, or much less of a close call, is where we saw all the violence and mayhem from protesters. We haven't seen that in Tulsa at all, from what I understand. Tulsa's actually reacted very peaceably to this. But even after all this happens, it won't be evidence of the system actually does hold police accountable, because people will say it's only because of things like Charlotte that there's accountability in places like Tulsa. That's one of the frustrations that I think we should prepare for.
Oh, I know. And what's happening in Charlotte is just so senseless. This was a black man who was shot by a black cop, and so black rioters decided to go and riot and terrorize the stadium of a predominantly black team in a largely black area of town. I don't follow the logic here. What was that supposed to accomplish? What is tearing down your own community supposed to accomplish? I don't understand it. And
I don't know if you saw the reports out there, Sean, that I think it was 70%, and this was Zero Hedge, so take that with a grain of salt, but it was linked to another source, that 70% of the arrestees from Charlotte had out-of-state licenses. So this seems like it might be sort of the mobile BLM movement showing up and causing mayhem, not even in their hometown.
Well, that's a great point, and the conspiracy theorist in me looks at what you mentioned about Oklahoma, about there not being riots there. Well, Oklahoma's not a swing state in November.
Oh, wow, that is kind of an interesting...
I mean, if your goal is to mobilize people and really get them out there and get them angry, and get them angry at the guy who you think is the crazy white supremacist racist, I could see the utility in the pure cynical utility in using stuff like that to gin up votes.
You know,
I'm not
always
saying that's what happened, but I could certainly see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly plausible. I thought it was kind of a reach, and people were saying that Soros was funding some of Black Lives Matter activists through some of the foundations and charities and activist groups that he gives money to. And then I saw Black Lives Matter protests in like Ireland, and I was like, actually, this isn't as crazy as I thought. Like, what is that all about? Why are there BLM activists in Ireland and other places too around the world, by the way?
Well, and the thing that really bothers me is that so many of the Black Lives Matter activists do have very legitimate grievances. I think there's plenty of evidence that blacks are often targeted only by the color of their skin. They're more likely to be stopped, to be frisked, to have police force use on them. And so, not all cops are perfect. I think every good cop in the world would admit to that. And so there is a good case that so many of these people that make that, there's something wrong here we need to address. But what they're doing, having riots and burning things down and inciting people to murder other people, that doesn't help their cause. It doesn't make it look more legitimate. It makes it look ridiculous, and it makes people sympathize not with the protesters and the rioters, but with the people who are trying to keep order. It's counterproductive.
Can we expect some Sean Davis live tweets and excellent analysis on thefederalist.com for Monday's debate?
You can guarantee it.
We'll take it to the bank. All right. Sean Davis, co-founder of The Federalist. Everyone give him a follow on Twitter. Sean, what's your Twitter handle?
Sean MDAV, SEANMDAV.
All right, team, give him a follow. Sean, great to have you. Have a fantastic weekend.
Thank you, Buck. You too.
Team, we got more. Stay with me.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Kennedy in North Carolina. You're on the Buck Sexton Show. What's up?
Hey, what's going on, Buck? How you been, brother? It's been a long time since I called you.
I'm all right, man. Thank you for calling.
Hey, I just wanted to apologize to you real quick, because I used to call your show a lot, write you on Facebook and stuff. I've never told you thank you for your services in the police department and what you've done overseas. I want to say thank you for your show, and that me and my family continue to pray for your show and the Blaze, and actually tell you, like you'd like to tell all your listeners to be sure to keep your shield high, brother. That's all.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. You're very kind. I appreciate all of that.
All right, brother.
Oh, okay. Nice call. I'll take it. I thought he was going to ask me a question after that. Well, shields high, Kennedy. Thank you, sir. That was cool. Yeah, I had a TSA dog handler come up to me in the Las Vegas airport, and it was nice. She was really excited. She was like, Buck Sexton. And I was like, I hope you don't think I have illegal substances on me, dog handler lady. But she didn't. She just wanted to say hi because she's Team Buck. So big, big hi and a big hug to her. That was very nice. Also, the guy sitting behind me on the airplane did one of those, you know, we sort of did like one of those, like, we're standing up, you know, what's up? And he's like, you're Buck Sexton, aren't you? And I was like, the guy's literally in the seat behind me. I was like, yeah. He's like, nice to meet you. My family and I watch you on Glenn's network and, you know, good stuff. I was like, thanks, bro. You're cool. Let's keep it casual here. I see what's up. Anyway, he was a very nice guy. All right, hour three coming up. We're going to talk about some fun stuff and some crazy stuff and some serious stuff. And it's the third hour. It's freestyle. Strap in, team.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, welcome to hour three in the Freedom Hunt. Switching gears for a second here. I assume that many of you are familiar with a writer named Andrew Sullivan. He's a talented writer. He's a very good writer. And a thoughtful guy. Don't agree with him on everything. Don't agree with him on a bunch of things. But he's a thoughtful person, and I appreciate that for what it is. You know, I also often mention to you, and I believe they were friends, Sullivan and Hitchens, that I liked a lot of Christopher Hitchens' writing. I appreciated his talent both as a writer and as a communicator, a speaker. Even though I thought on some issues, you know, I thought he really had a vendetta against the Catholic Church that pushed him to be unfair towards it. You know, I think that it was sort of over personalized for him for a number of reasons. Had a very difficult childhood. I don't know how, you know, it's among the more difficult things to hear that somebody's mother ran off with another man, not his father, and I believe committed suicide. I think that was what happened with Hitchens' mother. He was very scarred by that. His father was in the Navy, I believe, the British Navy. Anyway. Andrew Sullivan, also a Brit and an excellent writer. He's been openly gay for a long time. He's also open about the fact that he has HIV, which has obviously been is quite a struggle, even though people can live a long time with it now. My understanding is that there's a lot of drugs involved, and it's a lifelong burden psychologically, physically, and in every sense, in every way. And of course, there's no guarantee that the drugs and the protocols will work. All right. So that's Andrew Sullivan also was one of the early people to really sort of popularize a blog and monetize it. He created his own audience that way. And I have to say, I'm not somebody I've read a lot of Hitchens. I've read a ton of his articles. I've read many of his books. I'm much less well read on Sullivan's body of work. So I wanted to be clear with you about that at the onset. That way, if one of you sees some piece he wrote where you're like, Buck, how could you even mention this guy? Look at what he says here. I don't know everything that he's done, but he wrote a really very, I'm going to overuse the word thoughtful here, but he wrote a very introspective essay that was in New York Magazine. It's called I Used to Be a Human Being. He says, an endless bombardment of news and gossip and image has rendered us manic information addicts. It broke me. It might break you too. Now, it's probably from a business perspective, not a great idea for somebody who makes a living in the digital, particularly the sort of new media landscape that is created in the digital world, to say that there should be limitations to this. I really should sit here and be telling you all that you could never get enough tweets, never get enough podcasts, never get enough content online. But I always
am honest with you, my much beloved audience, Team Buck, really my friends. I always think of it more as my extended family than as an audience. I think that's one of the first times I've ever even used that word on the show. But the truth is that I do worry sometimes. I read this article, by the way, as I was sitting out at a lunch in Vegas by myself, and I was sort of doing what I do, which is flip through my phone at rapid speed, looking for either insights on Twitter or news stories in my feed or checking out Facebook. And I mean, this is the world that I'm in. In fact, one of the only times, and it's been one of the better things for me about getting back into the gym, which I've gone through periods where I didn't go to the gym, usually because of either illness or injury, and I tend to get a little chubbier. And then I finally am back in a place where I'm healthy enough to really work out the way that I want to. And I'm hoping to stay there for a while now. I've been there for, 4 or 5 months. So that's been great. But one of the things about it that I find particularly, I was actually telling Ty before, maybe I'll have time later, this should tell you a story. I witnessed quite an argument yesterday at the gym. Gym protocol is a funny thing. I was not a part of it. But that's one of the only times I do not bring my phone with me. There are really only two times, and I just realized this as I was reading this article, there are really only two times in my day where I am free of my smartphone. One of them is at the gym. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's sort of, for me, has turned into a psychological safe space. And I know that sometimes CNN has tried to call me and I've been at the gym. Like, I can't pretend I'm there for 4 hours. I pick up the heavy things and I put them down. Like, I'm not, if I can get like 20 or 30 minutes on the elliptical and, do some weights. Good job, Buck. But I'm just saying, it's one of the few times where I escape from this matrix-like world that we've all sort of created for ourselves. I know we're not human batteries and there's not these giant machines and everything, but I'm just saying we're in this constant state of connectivity. And I do think that it starts to sort of change the way our wiring works. Brain wiring is a very interesting thing. And people, the more they study it, the more they see that it is more complex than any machine, but in some ways it is machine-like. The synapses can start to function in a certain way in certain parts of the brain, and there can be changes in the brain due to trauma, and there can be, I mean physical trauma, I mean psychological trauma. And that feelings can sort of be mapped in different ways on the brain. I mean, study of the brain is one of the great wide open frontiers still. And I think it's one of the places as well where people are, that we want to know more, but we also are worried about what we're going to find out. I think there's that, isn't there a Bruce Lee line? It's like, our greatest fear is not that we're inadequate, it's that we're powerful beyond comprehension or something like that. Bruce Lee was cool. So we don't necessarily want to know everything about brains because we worry that it could be used for any number of bad things, right? All of a sudden we start to test, scan kids' brains. Well, who's violent? Who needs to be sort of pre-trained not to be violent? And, who's going to be really smart? And maybe we fast-track them. And we get into this Brave New World in the sort of dystopian Huxley sense. Of course, he's the author of Brave New World, where brain activity and brain structure and all that starts to become used in ways that are socially and morally problematic. Okay. So I do think that the constant connectivity issue is real. And this is one of the reasons also, and I will say this, why I appreciate so much those of you who listen to the show, whether live or on podcast. I value my time, and I know I have limited mental bandwidth to consume all of this information that's out there. And I view my job as doing the best I can to consume as much of it as possible and then bring you the absolute best of it in sort of my own personalized way. But because I value the time that I spend on this and know that it is finite, the fact that you spend your time with me, I really do consider to be a great honor, because I know you can't listen to 8 podcasts a day. I know you can't listen to 8 radio shows a day. I mean, maybe some of you have tried, but 24 hours of radio would be a lot. So that's one side of this. But as I go back to this piece that was written by Sullivan, he really talks about how he felt the need to disconnect because it started to change the way that he was interacting with people in his day-to-day life. It started to change the way he viewed day-to-day life, and that when he finally forced himself to disconnect, he would notice things in the world around him, appreciate things in the world around him in a way that he hadn't because he was so essentially desensitized to stimuli.
right? Because there's this part of your brain that's always processing new information and gets, you know, excited about new information. That's one of the reasons why I love my job, is I'm constantly searching for new information and also interesting information, and then I try to share it with all of you, and that's sort of the performance aspect of it. And this was why I was good and liked my job at the CIA, too. That was very specific kinds of information, but it was the same idea. It was processing large amounts of information, figuring out what is useful, and then distilling that, synthesizing that into something that is then either a finished product or has a specific utility. And that's kind of what I do every day now. So the CIA skills really have transferred directly into what I'm doing with all of you. But if you don't watch out, and this is what much of the Sullivan piece, and it's a long piece, and I do recommend if you have the time, you read it. I mean, it's definitely a couple thousand, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 words, is that taking the time to just have some quiet in the day. No TV, no phone, no nothing. Either be with people or be alone with your thoughts is increasingly essential, I think, to sort of maintaining a certain level of sanity. I mean, I don't think you're going to start talking to a park bench and think that it's talking back to you if you don't do this, but I'm just saying it's to keep your bearings and keep sort of a sense of context and what's important in your life. You do need to create some quiet spaces for yourselves. Oh, I said I have two. One of them is the gym, which is, you know, hopefully will keep me going. I'll probably stop and just start eating gluten-free cupcakes, you know, by the fistful in a couple of weeks. But the other is in the shower, because that's one of the only places where you can't bring your phone. And so you have quiet time in the shower, you have quiet time in the gym. But it would be good, and I'm starting to think I will do this, you know, to go for a walk without your phone. Another thing, by the way, that he mentions, and this is a huge issue for me. I have gotten into arguments with people about this. I'm very strict. If someone's eating with me, unless there is an emergency of some kind, I do not want to see their phone. I do not want to see them talking or texting on their phone. If we're sitting down to a meal, we are at a meal. If you need to excuse yourself once from the table to handle something, fine. But I have to say, and maybe some of you disagree and you don't mind, you don't care. When someone's phone is on that table with you and you're sitting down to eat dinner, they're never really present. There's actually really a third party at the table, and that third party is the most important one. And it's that connected, internet-enabled, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat-carrying device that sits, and text messaging and BlackBerry message, I mean, all that stuff, email, all of it, right there in someone's hand. It has become easier, I see this now also, for people to be in relationships where and I mean romantic relationships too, where their smart device sort of becomes a crutch, and it's a way of escape without actually having to escape, right? So you're just constantly interacting with friends and talking to other people and doing other things, and much less present. And there's sort of a different way I mean that word, but to really be present with the person that you're supposed to be with. And you know, it's changing the way we socialize. It's certainly changed the way that we meet people. It's changed the way we date. It's changed the way we communicate. These are big changes. I mean, say what you will about the TV, and I know, and Sullivan mentions this, ever since the printing press and ever since mass media came along, I think the first commercial radio station opened in Pittsburgh in 1920. I think that was the first commercial radio station. I do know it was Pittsburgh. I think it was in 1920. So you know, radio has been around for a long time. Obviously, TV came about after that. And there were people say, oh, well, we're going to all turn into zombies. Well, no, because there's only so much TV you're going to really watch realistically. And there's only so, and you can only do that when you're doing it. I mean, you can maybe have it on the background. There's only so much radio you can listen to, unless it's the Buck Sexton Show and the Freedom Hut, in which case there's never enough radio that you can listen to. But I think about this more all of the time now, because I do feel like, especially among some of my peers in media, it starts to resemble an addiction. And I don't like to throw the word addiction around, because I think that there are real sort of biochemical addictions, and then there are just very strong habits, and they're not the same thing. But to some of my peers, and I'm not really casting judgment, it's more just a sort of statement of concern, who, you know, have tweeted 300,000 times or something. I mean, that's too many tweets. Okay, it's just you're spending too much time on Twitter.
And, you know, I have to say that one of the reasons why I'm not constantly on Twitter is because I spend a lot of my time preparing for this show. I spend a lot of my time just being up to speed so that when I have to go on CNN or I do another show for The Blaze or the idea that I'm just going to sort of sit around all day and be constantly sharing thoughts. One, I think a lot of people get into a habit where they think that their thoughts are much, much more noteworthy and shareable than they are. And two, you get into this weird competition of, well, who can amass these followers? And by the way, a lot of people who have followings, I mean, I don't want to, I am actually not going to name names. This is not Preterizio where I'll pretend not to say something and then say it. Very interesting rhetorical device. But there are people who buy followers too. I mean, this sort of becomes it becomes a big game, and there's a lot of fraud in that game. But even for people that aren't in media, this is a concern. It's a distraction. And Sullivan in this piece, and you really have to read the piece because it's in depth, and he talks about how when he separates himself from his phone and goes for walks in the woods, all of a sudden he finds himself listening to birds, and then he finds himself crying. He finds himself thinking about his childhood. He finds himself thinking about relationships and struggles and things that just get suppressed by the constant flow of outside information. And I do think that there has to be a balance struck. I think that, you know, listen to the Buck Sexton Show, maybe some other stuff from The Blaze. You got a couple of websites and call it a day. But seriously, though, I mean, you need to examine these. I examine these parts of my life, too. And I wonder, you know, and also what's the sort of public face that someone has? What's the private face that someone has? True for all of us now in the Facebook era. I think it's so interesting that everyone wants to, not everyone, a lot of people like to create the impression that they always look amazing and they're always on vacation. You know, that's basically what Facebook has become. You're always at an edgeless or endless pool, whatever those things are. Everyone's always in, what are they called, Ty? You know what I mean? The pool that like you can't see the end of it? Infinity pool. Yeah, everyone's always in an infinity pool in some beautiful tropical destination, and everyone always looks perfect, or they're at a wedding with their, you know, either their best black tie or their, you know, makeup perfect or whatever. That's what you see on Facebook. Or people who have babies, lots of babies, but that's okay. But I mean, for the rest of us, it's a lot of pushing out a certain image to the world, and I think there should be greater focus on the actual interactions we're all having with each other. The dinner table is a critical one, by the way. No phones at the dinner table. I mean, maybe you have them on you, but no phones out. No one should be texting. No one should be doing anything. Meals, I think, are sacred. And I would have opposed people sitting at the dinner table reading the newspaper with their kids around them, too, when that was what was going on. Some people still do that. But to be present and not allow the digital world to intrude on every aspect of your life and become the defining sort of the defining interaction you have with reality is a struggle now. It is real. It's something we should think about. That all said, download the Buck Sexton Show. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, I have to admit, I have no idea about how some certain things are done these days or how they work. Like, when I was just asking Ty, when do you give your kid a smartphone? Because I feel like that's such a, and you really have to sort of teach them and train them and, you know, this is a whole world. I mean, when I was in high school, the cool thing was if you had a beeper and your parents could, and you're obviously it was really just so your friends could find you, but people could, you know, send you a beep and then you have to call that number back. I mean, that was about as, I think I got my first cell phone junior or senior year of high school. I think I can't even remember now. Yeah, I remember I had a StarTAC at one point, which I still was like, I thought the coolest thing ever. Ty agrees with me. It was a very cool phone. But that's so, you know, phone calls is one thing, But to hand some person who's still learning about the world a device that records audio and video and takes photos and gets you on the internet and lets you post on message boards. I mean, I don't know, parents. I don't know how you guys do it. I tip my hat to you. I have no idea how that goes. I assume there's like a whole protocol now for how parents talk to their kids about this. I just, all I can say is it's a good thing I didn't have a smartphone when I was in high school, because I was a little maniac running around getting drunk, and I definitely would have, you know, there'd be photos of me drinking Old English out of a 40 on a stoop somewhere. I mean, not that I ever did that, but like, I'm just surmising, you know, I'm just coming up with that. That was a thing that people were doing then. Not me, though. I was in the library studying. But yeah, I don't know how people, the perils of technology today. So many advantages, but also so many risks. All right, team. We're going to talk about some other pop culture stuff coming up in a minute, so stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show.
We got Caitlin Collins, who is the Daily Caller's entertainment editor, on the line. Caitlin, great to hear from you.
Hey, Buck, how are we doing?
I'm good, thank you. You know, some people get very excited about Charles Cook and Tom Rogan calling in because of their British accents. I think that Caitlin Collins with her Southern accent is my favorite accent we have on the show.
Well, I was home last weekend, so I think it got a little bit worse while I was gone from D.C.
If it's a little more country now, that's fine with me. So, tell us some stuff. Tell us some stuff about the Clinton Foundation, Caitlin. They've got some layoffs coming. I thought the Clinton Foundation was unstoppable.
Apparently not. It seems to be unraveling before our very eyes. They are apparently about to lay off dozens of staffers before the end of the year. And a lot of that can be blamed on the controversy surrounding the Clinton Foundation over the past few weeks.
Like what? What's going on?
Well, we've had a lot of issues of fundraising money and Hillary Clinton doing favors for people because they donated to the Clinton Foundation while she was Secretary of State, and then she gave them government access that they wouldn't have normally had. And so now two former Clinton Foundation officials have said that they're getting ready to lay off dozens of people by the end of the year.
Doesn't that look bad, though? I mean, doesn't it look like all the criticism about the Clinton Foundation, if that results in lots of layoffs from the Clinton Foundation, isn't that something that, you know, sort of shows the critics are right?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. And, I mean, Bill Clinton has said that he's going to step down, quit raising money for the foundation if Hillary Clinton wins, and they're, instead of shutting the foundation down entirely, which they think will hurt people, they're just going to pass the reins on to their daughter, Chelsea. So it's not really like there's going to be a big degree of separation if he does step down.
All right. So we'll have to see then what happens there. Also, we got the debate coming up on Monday. Mark Cuban, the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks. I know him best from his appearances on Shark Tank, which is actually a very entertaining show, I find. Although not because of Mark Cuban. Mr. Wonderful's he's the interesting one. Mark Cuban, I find kind of boring on Shark Tank. But he's going to be sitting in the front row at the presidential debate. Hasn't he been sort of trying to bait Trump into a debate or something? He's been trying to get up in Trump's grill, hasn't he?
Yeah, he offered to pay him $10 million if he would debate him on stage. And he said he would love to be a moderator because he would crush Trump. But I do think it's pretty ironic, and I wonder what Bernie Sanders supporters think that they've put a billionaire in the front row at the debate. And I do think it's just so he can, you know, mess with Trump. He's going to be right there looking into Trump's eyes as him and Hillary Clinton go head-to-head during the debate Monday.
Well, the thing is, I think Mark Cuban is worth, you know, whatever it is, $10 billion or $20 billion, or, you know, he's worth a lot more than Trump actually is, and so I feel like he's gonna try to get inside Trump's head with that issue. But I don't think Trump's gonna care very much. It's interesting though that the theatrics of all this setting up. By the way, is there something about there's no break allowed or something? This is getting traction too, right?
Yes, that's another big revelation we found out today. There will be no commercial breaks during the 90 minutes that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are on stage. And I don't think it's medically advisable to have two 70-year-olds on stage for 90 minutes and not let them go to the bathroom. But that could just be me.
I don't think I could go 90 minutes without having to take a potty break. That seems a little excessive.
I know. So it's going to be intense. They said they're going to have about 1,000 journalists in the crowd watching. So journalists, Mark Cuban, me and Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will all be there.
Are you going to be watching? You're going to be at the debate?
Definitely. Of course. Oh. I wouldn't miss it.
Oh, well, look at you. Look at you, fancy lady. No one asked me to the debate. You're going to have to tell it. You'll have to be live tweeting so we can all share in the experience. One more. What is this about Kim Kardashian going to law school?
Okay, yes. Okay, so Kim Kardashian has decided she wants to go to law school. She's also said previously that she wants to be a forensic investigator. But the biggest Kim Kardashian revelation today, and quite possibly the weirdest one that we will ever see, is that apparently Caitlyn Jenner, her stepmom, stepdad, whatever you'd like to call her, has convinced Kim Kardashian to switch her support from Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump.
Really?
Yes. Kim Kardashian has been a big Hillary Clinton supporter ever since she met her at a fundraiser in Los Angeles last fall. She took a selfie with her. Of course, it's Kim Kardashian. And in an interview published just a few minutes ago, she said that she had a long talk with Caitlyn Jenner, who is a very well-known Republican, and that Caitlyn Jenner might have convinced her to vote for Trump. She said she's on the fence now.
Oh, very interesting. Anything else? Are we going to be seeing a piece from you about the debate coming up on Monday or any other stuff you've got on the docket?
Definitely. It's all debate coverage right now. And with this election, you never know what's going to happen. So I don't even pretend like I can predict what's next.
All right. Caitlin Collins of The Daily Caller, where she's entertainment editor. Caitlin, have a fantastic weekend. I assume you'll be watching some college football. Enjoy.
Yes. Roll Tide.
Roll Tide. Take care. And Ty just booed. Well, Ty, what's your team? You can come on air. Tell me what's your football team of choice for the college stuff.
The Ohio State University.
All right. College football is this whole world that I don't understand at all. Because my football team in college, the kids were like my size and we were terrible and it was D3 and nobody cared. They cared, but nobody else cared. So this whole notion of like an 80,000 person stadium full of cheering college fans and everything, our stadium, there are high schools with much bigger stadiums than my college had. So we were like, anyway, and I think there were high school teams that would have kicked my team's butt. So this notion of rooting for a college football team was well beyond me. Actually, not long ago, I remember being on a date with a girl who's like, and she was Southern, so apologies for this. She was like, I mean, if you don't watch college football, like, I don't think this is going to work. And I was like, ooh, whoa. Of course I watch the college football.
Yeah, they go to church on Sunday.
It did not work.
Yeah, they go to church on Sunday, so the NFL's not as big. So the college thing, that Saturday experience, is huge down there. Like, they pack 125,000 people in the stadiums.
They can hear you, right? Otherwise, I'm just sitting here saying, yeah. Okay, good. All right. I'm just the guy that's, yeah. It's great radio you're doing there, Buck. No, Ty, that's a very important point. I didn't think about that. And I do love the show Friday Night Lights, even though that show is essentially, let's take some coastal elites and plop them in Texas and pretend that they're Southerners, even though they're in Texas, but both Chandler and Connie Britton are, I think they're both from the South. I forget where, but have a very sort of East Coast attitude. Let's also do the thing of having mostly 30-year-olds playing high school kids. I don't know why they have to do that. I mean, aren't there some good 22-year-old actors who could play like a 15 or 16-year-old? I just think it's one of the things you go back and watch, like Beverly Hills 90210, which many of you are like, what? Don't worry about it. It was a show that was on in the 90s. It's neither here nor there. Those of you who are older than me are like, I can't believe you're bringing up Beverly Hills 90210. But they had people who were in their late 20s playing high school kids, maybe even early 30s. And that just seems weird to me. Like, it's not that hard to play a high school kid. You're basically just constantly, you're living in a state of social anxiety and doubting yourself. And usually it mostly sucks until you either realize you don't care or you get out of there. So there's that. I finished Stranger Things last night, by the way, speaking about where they actually have kids playing kids. Good show. I dig it. I give it a B plus, A minus. I think that's fair. Going to a break. We'll be right back.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team, I never want to antagonize or irritate or goad any of you, especially on a Friday show right before we go away for the weekend. You know, it's like, don't go to bed angry. Don't go off into the Friday weekend, irked at Mr. Sexton over here. So I'm going to try to be, we're going to try to have a delicate conversation about this. So there are reports in right now. There are some reports in that Ted Cruz, who sleeps with, I think, an original copy of the Constitution under his pillow, who every year for Halloween only dresses up as one of the founding fathers, who memorized the Constitution, I think it was at age 3. I think before he could even speak, he memorized the Constitution, and is a man of unbending prints. I know I'm being a little punk, but just let me have some fun. There are reports, they're just reports, they may not be true, that he is going to today endorse Donald Trump for the presidency of the United States. Now, we're not there yet where I can, we'll see. There is the possibility, and I raised this with Ty in one of the breaks, that this is going to be actually a moment for Ted Cruz to sort of take the spotlight and say that he's pleased with some of the moves that Donald has been making. He appreciates that Donald has been running a more mature campaign recently. And he understands the need to defeat Hillary Clinton. So he applauds Donald's moves in the right direction and withholds endorsement for now. I think that's possible. Perhaps these are also just rumors that are out there right now, and that nothing will happen, that the Cruz campaign isn't going to say anything, although people close to Cruz have been saying all day, and there's various reports coming in, that he's going to endorse. I'm very curious to see if this happens. I do recall receiving a tremendous amount of heat, probably the most heat I have received from my family. And you can give me heat. If you can't handle the heat, get out of the Freedom Hut, right? Where it's always a balmy 75 with a light breeze. But I remember people very upset when I said that I didn't think that Cruz taking the podium at the Republican convention and not endorsing, I didn't find that at the time to be helpful. Now, if Cruz does endorse, which he has not done yet, we'll see. We can have a discussion as to whether that was intended to redirect the Trump campaign more towards a actually Republican, I won't even say conservative, a Republican platform, and that he was trying to help shape the campaign. That is certainly one version of analysis that one could give if Ted Cruz is to do, as is reported he will do today, and he endorses Donald Trump. I will say to you, and I will withhold it for now, that there are other analyses that could be offered up of such a Cruz move at this time. But because it has not happened, I will withhold on that. I would like to see if it happens. There's certainly the case to be made, as I said, that it was all about trying to influence the campaign in a responsible fashion, to influence the Trump campaign in a responsible fashion. And that is what caused the non-endorsement at the Republican National Convention. There's also the argument to be made that doesn't really matter, who cares, Buck. Fine. Maybe that's a point too. Although at the time, it seemed like it mattered to a lot of people. People were kind of upset over that one. I remember not everyone was quite so happy with that whole thing. So, we shall see, everybody. We shall see. I did get a lot of feedback is a nice way of putting it. When I said that it seemed like Mark Levin had sort of changed his tune on Trump, people who listen to Mark. I don't listen to Mark often. I've listened to clips of him here and there that make their way into the media, but I've got my own show to do, obviously. But I had heard, you know, I've sort of read the media coverage of his positions on Trump and thought that he was firmly never Trump. Apparently he wasn't never Trump. He had said that he at one point couldn't vote for him, but didn't say he would never vote for. I don't know that Mark didn't switch as much as I thought he would. Fine. I don't pretend to speak for Mark at all. And of course, and don't know what he's saying. I just saw the coverage of it and thought, oh, somebody who's come over to the Trump side. Apparently he was just withholding judgment until he saw fit to finally endorse, or not endorse, but, you know, say who he would vote for, which is even different, I think, than endorsing. We'll see about this Cruz thing. It will be interesting. We will have to have a chat, everybody, if Cruz formally endorses Donald Trump for president, about how that whole process played out, I think. And we'll see. Let me just say this to all of you. I have always been honest with you about where I am on Trump. And there, look, I could have, if I had thrown my lot in with Trump early on when it was clear that he was going to be a thing, I'd be on CNN every day. It would be, you know, and if I was willing to just sort of say anything to defend him, it would have been a huge boost to the visibility of someone like me, which is unfortunately, for better or for worse, a huge part of what this career is. It's just visibility, people knowing who you are. But I couldn't do it. I can't just defend any Trump position. That said, I've also always been never Hillary. I have never, ever, ever been never Trump, because I did not want to be in the position of seeming like I was just riding the waves of popularity when I could. And then in the moment that it looked like it was a better way to go in the other direction. And this hasn't been easy. As somebody who works at The Blaze, Glenn is never Trump. Many of the other hosts are never Trump. They have, and I give them total credit and appreciate this greatly. They've never tried to influence me or push me in that direction against my will. Glenn has always given me complete editorial freedom on this show, which is one of the reasons why I am as loyal and thankful to The Blaze as I am. They let me be who I am. But it hasn't been easy, obviously. I mean, I listen to Glenn in the morning sometimes, and I hear what they're saying about Trump, and I come here and. And they're still obviously never Trump, but Ted Cruz, we'll see. We'll see, everybody. All I'm saying is I love all of you, and so I tell you the truth, and we'll see if everybody has shown you that same respect and love all along. That's all I'm saying. Maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's nothing. I should have just talked about Back to the Future in this segment or something else instead. I'm realizing that now, but it's okay. I heart you all. There's that. Please download the show, guys. I'm really excited to talk to you all on Monday. I'll be back in every day next week. Have a great weekend. Shields high.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.